Welcome. Hola. Bienvenidos. Bonjour et bienvenue to the Social Network Show. Welcome to the only worldwide show dedicated to social networking and social media. We give you actionable information to make your social networking the best it can be for business to business, business to consumer, and for folks who just like to post. And now, broadcasting from the studios of the Hank Greenspoon School of Journalism and Media Studies of UNLV, the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, the host of the Social Network Show, Jim Nico, and Dr. Jane Kawaski.
Welcome to the Social Network Show. You're listening to us from Las Vegas, Nevada. And I am Jane Kawaski, Dr. J, with Jim Nico. And Jim is the ever-imaginative leader of the expedition here. We're going to be talking with Sandy Garasino and Joe Ulatowski. Sandy, of course, is active in the Red Hood Project, designed to make safer environments online for children especially. And Joe is a philosophy professor that deals with ethics and social media and the online world. So first of all, we have Sandy. Welcome to the show, Sandy.
Good morning. How are you?
We're pretty good.
Yes, thank you. And welcome back.
Thanks so much for having me.
So we have talked about a couple of things in preparation for the show today, one of which is what has happened with Ask.fm. In making changes to their safety policy because of a number of teen suicides related somewhat to content on their online network, which is designed to enable people to ask questions and then give answers. And sometimes the questions or the answers are not at all polite and sometimes very, very distressing to teens. And so, Sandy, do you think that their changes are going to make a difference? Or do you think they're really being upfront about this? And how does it compare to Facebook's reaction?
Well, my perspective on this is that this is largely a PR move by Ask.fm. The key element here is that they haven't defined what their goal is. They haven't defined what they're aiming to achieve. That means that there's no way of measuring whether or not they've achieved their objective or not. There's no way of telling what they're doing. Really, what they're trying to do is make up for the PR disaster that took place when they basically mocked the UK girl Hannah Smith, who took her own life after being bullied. They were seen putting on helmets, presumably to make a joke out of the fact that they were being attacked. These kinds of things. They came off as just absolute buffoons, fools, and contemptuous of the whole process. So when we see these kinds of announcements, what we would like to see, what the Red Hood Project wants to see, is clearly defined objectives, metrics for determining whether or not those objectives are being met, and clear deliverables, benchmarks, and milestones that the public, that are transparent to the public, to demonstrate: are you meeting your objectives? Are you creating a safe environment? I don't see any sign of that.
Now, have they had any idea? I mean, the report which I read from TechCrunch said that they had experts that they had consulted with and professional advisors of the site and the safety features, but apparently they weren't people who had the idea of objectives and metrics or ways of measuring these things, as you suggest. Now, what you're suggesting to me sounds very scientific in the way to go about it. And of course, it's not new to business to work with things like that. That's pretty common business practice, I believe. Mm-hmm. So, what kind of advice do you think they were getting? PR management advice?
they're getting PR management advice, and they're getting advice from, they suffered the loss of advertising revenue. There were a number of advertisers that withdrew from the Ask FM site. So this is entirely about, as far as I can see from the external perspective, this is about saving that that revenue. This is not about making substantive, significant changes to their moderation. One of the things that they have said that they want to do is to amend the report button and an additional category to be completed by September 2013. This is what's supposed to be around reporting new members of the moderation team, but no definition of how many members of the moderation team, and a safety officer to be in place by January 2014, and an opt-out button allowing users to opt out of receiving anonymous questions, which is pretty much the point of Ask FM, is to be anonymous. So these are cosmetic changes. How you measure these things, just to give a sense, I don't want to draw too much attention to Facebook because Facebook still has a long way to go, but just to give a little bit of a sense, Facebook and McDonald's are now roughly the same in terms of market capitalization, the value of the company. Facebook has something under 15,000 employees. McDonald's has about 1 million employees worldwide. So that gives you a sense of just what the labor component of these companies is. McDonald's is very high labor. Facebook is minimal. Ask FM is probably, now they're not publicly reporting, so we can't really tell, but I suspect that they are absolute rock bottom in terms of the number of bodies they have.
I believe I saw 25 in that vicinity. Yeah.
Well, and here they're supervising, you know, hundreds of millions of kids.
Right.
So to get back to the playground analogy, which I keep mentioning, can you imagine running a playground or a school where you've got hundreds of millions of users and you've got 25 people monitoring it? This is clearly a ludicrously impossible task.
Right.
So this is all about PR, as far as I can tell.
Well, what's interesting is the things that they're going to start doing shows how little they were doing, because it was possible to ask questions without registering in any way on the site. Mm-hmm. You know, you just think, well, this is now that they are saying that they'll be using an email verification on sign up and can capture the email and IP addresses of users and be better equipped to deal with reports, which means that prior to this, they weren't equipped at all. But now this sounds ludicrous to you, and I want you to tell us and our listeners why is you laugh at that.
It was simply an automated system. Somebody came in the morning and turned the lights on, and there's no possible way that you can even begin to start monitoring. You probably couldn't even seriously moderate the complaints that they would have got, simply the complaints that they already would have been getting. You can tell they can't moderate. I've had a fair amount of experience now dealing with Facebook, with a situation where kids are being victimized, and I mean it's very, very difficult even with Facebook. I mean, they have, all of these companies have very far to go, but the key element here is, what is their business model? The business model is to get advertising revenue from marketers and advertisers who simply want to know how many eyeballs are on your site. Mm-hmm. Can we get access to the eyeballs? That's the business model. So in this business model, where is safety for the user? There is none, because the user is not the customer.
Mm-hmm.
The customer is the advertiser. The user is the product. They don't care about the safety of the product. So what's really key here is that there have to be disincentives and penalties built into the business model, costs to the business model for problems and for failures. One of the concerns that Red Hood has about all of the social media companies is that so far the primary objective appears to be to have a report abuse button of some kind. Twitter is following this model. There's pressure on Facebook to do this. Here, Ask FM is doing this. But what do we know? I mean, Dr. J, you are a professional in this field. What do we know about how much kids will report abuse? What percentage of kids report abuse, even when it's happening?
Well, we do know. I mean, Jane, did you want to?
Well, it's not high. I can tell you that.
It's a small minority. Yeah. So even the report abuse model can only ever capture a small minority. And kids who are being most viciously abused, they're afraid of their abusers. And right. They're afraid of what will happen if the abusers discover that they've been reported. This is why it's absolutely critical that there be an independent monitoring function. So that if a kid does report abuse, they can always pretend to the world outside that these people were just caught by patrollers, if you know what I'm saying.
Right. In other words, depending upon the abused to report it is not is not a reliable or effective manner. Coming up next, we're going to continue this discussion, and especially with regard to what an effective moderation program look like.
Questions? Comments? Email us at questions@thesocialnetworkshow.com. We'll be right back.
Kelly Keller, an intellectual property attorney specializing in internet law and social media issues. Join me on The Kelly Keller Show right here on the Social Network Station. Together with my guests, we will tackle tough legal problems presented by the ever-increasing use of social media in everyday business. Through dynamic conversations, we will discuss your rights and responsibilities in the new media world so the hard work you have put into developing your brand, business, and products does not go to waste. How does the law's response to the social media explosion affect you? Join me on The Kelly Keller Show to learn more.
Now, back to The Social Network Show.
You're listening to The Social Network Show with Sandy Garasino, and we've been talking about whether or not the social network sites seem to get the point that to depend upon the person, or many times the young people or children, to report abuse is not an effective way of reducing abuse, because so many of them will not, for one reason or another, oftentimes fear.
Yeah, and one thing I wanted to mention, and this came up with Henry from MIT, and the project that they were working on in terms of over the line, under the line with MTV. We talked about it before, but I think it's very interesting that, you know, in line with what we just talked about, if a kid is being abused right in real time, right now, and there's a lot of fear, and I've said in posts before that they tend to freeze when they don't know what to do. And what we're hoping, we want to get back with Henry at MIT, what I'm hoping is that when something like some kind of measurement tool monitors it from an independent source, monitors that bullying language, some kind of harassing or manipulative language is occurring, a pop-up would happen on the screen and the child would know exactly where to go, a phone number, a website, et cetera. So that's what we're trying to get in place.
What I found interesting was looking at a book by Hinduja and Patchen, they write a great deal about school climate and how they're both from the criminal justice background. But the book was written in 2009, and at the time, MySpace was the dominant network. But as they said, it's true. Many of the principles they pointed out are applicable as things change, and they expected things to change. But they emphasized that so much of the effort, the tools that are supposed to help parents monitor really depend upon the honesty of the person registered on the site. Do they use their usual email, or have they gone and set up a new free email that isn't going to be monitored? And they had very much the same response to the response MySpace had at that time, as you just expressed, Sandy, with Ask FM, that so much of it is just superficial and not going to really make a difference. So what could we come up with in terms of what an effective moderation program would look like? What do you think would be most essential?
Well, probably the key essential component is, what is the objective? And obviously, you're not always going to get 100% achievement of your objective. But I would say that we should have measurements about what are key components of what you want to achieve. I think what Red Hood Project is saying is, for instance, that no adult stranger should be able to contact a child through social media anonymously. Just period. That should just be a very, very simple key objective. Does your system permit an anonymous adult to contact an anonymous adult stranger to contact and engage with a child? If it does, that is a major security failure. So that's just one thing that we would be looking at. This is why the Red Hood Project says over and over again, we have to get to user authentication. Even a Gmail address is not user authentication. That wouldn't suffice for PayPal. We want to have a PayPal-style user authentication method. Once you've got that, then you've got some kind of traction. You've got something to bootstrap everything else on. You've got a foothold because you can identify who the users are. Then what we would like to see is not merely reactive but active supervision, and there have to be consequences, real significant penalties for users who abuse the system. So here's an example. Last week we had the Slane girl situation, a girl in Ireland who was photographed, and the photographs were disseminated of her performing a sex act at a concert. These went through social media like wildfire. Facebook actually reacted quickly, not quickly enough. It took them 12 hours, but in 12 hours they had cleaned their site of references to this girl. Her page was taken down. Her name was not searchable on the site. No references to Slane Girl were visible on the site. Twitter had a different approach, and that was kind of interesting. One of the things that Twitter did was to suspend the accounts of anyone who shared or retweeted the photograph. Now, that was only a temporary suspension. We think that this should be a permanent suspension, or let's say a three-month suspension. 24-hour suspension does not really deter people from abusive conduct. So there needs to be a penalty that is a real deterrent. There needs to be independent active supervision and moderation so that the child does not feel that everything depends on them. And a third measure that we think is really key is the role of the bystander, because this is what everybody involved in the bullying sphere and abuse sphere understands now, is that the power of the bully comes from the audience.
Mm-hmm.
It comes from the bystander. This is why social media is so key, because the audience is massive. So what we'd like to see is much more emphasis not on the report abuse, but it's not just a tool for the victim. It is a tool for bystanders. And that all users, there should be an ethic that is started to, that is enculturated into the entire social media community, that if you witness abusive behavior, you have an obligation to report abuse. So that report abuse doesn't only come from the victim, it comes from this huge audience. Give that audience some power. This is just the beginning of the thinking around this, but have a clear objective, have penalties for people who abuse the system, and have independent moderation.
Interestingly enough, I ran into a company, Bully Tag, and I've been communicating somewhat with them. I'm working on getting closer to them, but what they have is similar to what you just described, in the sense that they can take a phone, like say there a bullying situation would happen on our metaphorical playground, but even maybe a literal playground. All of a sudden a kid is being bullied, and now they're empowering the bystander by the bystander being able to take a picture of this, but the picture is automatically not erased, but invisible. If a bully would see the picture happen, they can come and say, "Are you taking a picture?" And they cannot see it, but there's a record. The record of the picture goes to the principal of the school or the authorities. So I'm working, trying to get closer and more information on that. But that, interestingly enough, would, I think, be at least analogous to the kind of thing we're looking for.
Mm-hmm. And I think there's this kind of actually using the power of the social media itself can be very, very effective. I really like that idea. I mean, the key thing about the Flame Girl situation, the most abusive person is the one who was talked about the least. That's the person with the smartphone who took the photograph and then disseminated it.
Mm-hmm.
So what you're talking about, Jim, where the community itself can take its own corrective measures, I think is really significant. While you were talking, you were reminding me, Jim, of PayPal system, where users are actually rated, buyers and sellers. You know, did they perform the way they were supposed to? And there's a rating system. It isn't just that they are authenticated, but they're actually rated by other users as to how responsible they are as users in the system. And wouldn't that be an interesting thing?
Right, taking the practices from other areas, and I think that's a very good thing to bring up, is a lot of this authentication, it's being done. It's perfectly possible. Like you say, in commerce and PayPal. The other thing is that it's possible to not only authenticate them, but hold them responsible, as you mentioned, and to where And the witnesses, and like you say, the bystanders, if a method is developed where it's easy and non-threatening to report abuse, that would be encouraging them to do it. In our next segment, we're going to be talking to the philosophy and ethics person about, you know, what is the trade-off, you know, where, for instance, it might be possible if people are indemnified for reporting abuse, how can we stop people reporting abuse that isn't really happening, just to mm-hmm. get back to someone, which actually sadly happens in the child neglect and abuse field, where relatives or friends who want to get back at somebody or have a argument with them will call Child Protective Services and report them.
Exactly. I mean, just about every systemic corrective that you can mention or think of will have its own potential abuse coded in, as it were. So, I mean, we're at early days in shaping the internet, and imaginative people will come up with new innovations, and we're going to imperfectly get there, but we always have to be driving in that direction.
One thing I wanted to mention too, Sandy, that I'm now getting via LinkedIn and Twitter very sophisticated professional broadcast people from around the world, the UK. I've got radio executives and television executives from the networks contacting me now. They're really starting, and I think a lot of it has to do with that we're your show. Some of the key people, I mean, our audience is not as big as it needs to be, but we're starting to really get the attention from some of the professionals that can drive the audience participation. So it's the quality of what I think you're saying in interrelation with Dr. J that's really starting to gain us the traction.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are just so many. There are so many good people that have a lot to say about this, and let's do everything we can to amplify their voices.
That's very true, and we hope that our listeners will be a part of that by sharing the website and the show with others they know, and so that we can all work together to promote the changes that will make a big difference, and especially our thanks to the Red Hood Project, because you folks are really doing a great work. And I think, like you say, we're trying to be thinking ahead and determining, like you say, what are the objectives, what are the ways of measuring the accomplishment of the objectives. So thank you very much for joining us again, Sandy Garosino from Vancouver, BC.
Thanks so much for having me.
Want to be a guest on the Social Network Show? Email us at guest@thesocialnetworkshow.com. We'll be right back.
Today in school, I learned a lot. In chemistry, I learned that no one likes me. In biology, I learned that I'm fat. I'm stupid. In English, I learned that I'm disgusting. And in gym, I learned that I'm pathetic and a joke. The only thing I didn't learn in school today is why no one ever helps.
Kids witness bullying every day. They want to help, but they don't know how. Teach them how to stop bullying and be more than a bystander at stopbullying.gov. A message from the Ad Council.
Now, back to the Social Network Show.
And on the Social Network Show now, we're going to be speaking to a professor of philosophy who deals with the ethics involved in the social network world and online world, Joe Ulatowski, who is a visiting professor at the University of Texas, El Paso, UTEP. And he's also deputy editor of the Polish Journal of Philosophy. Joe is right up our alley because he has done research on the nature of self and deception in and among members of social networks, such as Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, and Google+. Hi, Joe. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Dr. J and Jim. Thanks for having me today. Appreciate it.
So, you know, our emphasis is on the question, what can social network site owners do to protect members from being bullied or abused on their sites? And so I think that you might be able to help us shed some light on some of the ethical issues involved. On ethics is always a case of one thing and balance with another thing. So what can you tell us about that, the approach or the viewpoint from an ethicist standpoint?
Well, certainly, one of the things that cyber bullies have on their side, it seems, is anonymity. And anonymity has been a problem for ages within philosophy, starting as far back as the ancient Greeks, especially in Plato. And there's the myth of the Ring of Gyges, and if you're unfamiliar with that, it's just basically this. This character, Gyges, finds a ring that makes him invisible, such that he takes advantage of that invisibility in order to take over a kingdom. And so given his newfound anonymity, he uses it for his own interest, right? So basically, we're nice to others, as it seems, according to the story, treat them fairly, etc., don't bully them, only because we either benefit from helping them or we're worried what others will think of us if we don't help. And so hiding behind the space of anonymity, right, it seems that people will do whatever it is that they want to do in their own self-interest. Now, more recently, among a cohort of ethicists, mostly moral, what they call moral psychology, as well as social psychologists, economists, et cetera, have been actually studying this. And as it turns out, people, for the most part, right, don't actually act in ways that are self-interestedly and do these harmful things like you see in cyberbullying, but rather act altruistically. In other words, care for others when they do certain actions online or in real time, so to speak, in the practical world. Now, that leaves social network, the industry of social networking, so, you know, companies like Facebook and Twitter, et cetera, right, to be a little bit more paternalistic in their guidelines. And so the idea here is then what kind of guideline it is that's beneficial to its users, right, such that you don't impede certain users, but you protect the most vulnerable users among these social networking websites, such as, you know, children or the elderly or whatever the case may be. People are a little bit less aware of the issues that might come up or whatnot in the social network site.
Joe, let me ask you a question about the anonymity. It keeps coming up. It's the thread that keeps weaving itself through all of our conversations. Is it literally, in your opinion, is there any way around anonymity? In other words, is there a way to remain anonymous and not pose a dangerous situation to kids on these social networks, or is it just black and white? I mean, we're hearing black and white. We have to get rid of the anonymity part. And what do you think? I mean, is there a gray area, or is it black and white?
Yeah, unfortunately, it is not nearly as black and white as we'd like it to be. I mean, clearly, it would be great if we could just say, hey, you know what? Let's get rid of this anonymity stuff and you know, the ability for users to be anonymous, and everything is going to be fine. Because unfortunately, there are cases out there, there are certain examples I'll call on to you here shortly, right, where it's actually important for users to be anonymous on these social websites. And I include among that not only just Facebook and Twitter, which I think is the gray area. These are the sorts of websites where it might not be good to be anonymous. But like on blogging, for instance, within philosophy, there are actually numerous blogs available to professional philosophers that enable them to engage with the profession where they can remain anonymous. And so, for instance, one example could be job candidates, right? The job candidates lamenting the situation within the amount of the number of potential jobs available and the sorts of things that go on of how it is that people are obtaining jobs, whether it's, you know, who you know rather than what you know, and it kind of is upsetting. But these graduate students, these people coming out of school, actually want to hide behind, be anonymous, so to speak, because they don't want to, they fear retaliation from the profession generally. Even worse than that. I mean, even worse than the situation with job candidates are, you know, philosophy is dominated by men. And unfortunately, there are some men out there, especially more senior members of the profession, it seems. This is what it says on this one particular website, blog, who have exploited the women, graduate students and junior members of the faculty. And there's this website, What Is It Like to Be a Woman in Philosophy? And actually, all of these posts are terrible stories of you know, professors taking advantage of these young women, or women generally, and telling about how they've been sexually harassed, I mean, literally sexually assaulted, and these sorts of things. And so it's good to get that out there to air just how bad the situation is so that we can put into place certain guidelines so that it doesn't happen, and that if something like this does happen among members of the profession, that we can somehow exorcise them out, or just, you know, get them out of the profession, or otherwise, you know, have some kind of recourse against those particular members of the profession.
So you're saying that if just anybody could find out who those women are, that it could be the person who harassed them to begin with, and therefore they could be liable for retaliation. Is that the thought?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, absolutely. It leaves them susceptible to potential retaliation. And, of course, we don't want that to happen at all. Yeah, it's unfortunate that this happens. And I'm sure it's just not in philosophy. It's just the one that I'm relatively aware of. Oh. I'm sure it happens in business all the time.
Oh, definitely. And it's comparable to political dissent. In many countries, too, of course,
sure.
Where it could be definitely a matter of life and death, you might say, in some of the autocratic regimes, that if someone is discovered, in fact, that has been a major problem in some countries where they have been able to identify bloggers or commenters, even in terms of objecting to their power, so they want to silence the opposition, you might say.
Joe, in essence, seeing this, and thank you for pointing out the justified anonymity. I mean, it's certainly in the workplace. You have the anonymous, the whistleblower protections, et cetera, and that's, I think that's very powerful for us to know, to remind ourselves of that. What do you have any predictions about where this whole social networking, bullying, manipulation online, where it's going, and if you do, is there anything that you recommend for the layperson?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I hope that, let me put it this way, I don't know exactly what's going on within these companies, but I would hope that given some of the newer policies that have been set into place, especially in Facebook, they're actually now scanning your status updates for types of words that you'd associate with some kind of criminal activity, and they include among that cyberbullying, these sorts of things, and predatory type language towards, you know, children or other people, even just within their network. And I think that's one way to do it. I think the other thing is, you know, there's a sense in which we all, as I'll call them netizens, right? We're all netizens, in a sense. We have to take it upon ourselves to really, you know, be cognizant of what our friends are saying to one another, whether or not some kind of status update is unusual for this, you know, one of your friends that, you know, somebody posts to their page and you're like, that doesn't seem right. I think it's up to us to say something. I mean, you know, I remember when I was living in Las Vegas, I'm not sure if the billboard's still there, but on the I-15, I mean, and I'm sure it's all over the country as well, right? There's that billboard, see something, say something, right? So I think part of it is, you know, we have to be aware of our surroundings, not only in so-called real time, you know, getting around the world, but also on the metaverse, you know, out there when you're cruising these social websites, you know, if something looks out of place, if something seems to be wrong with the sort of status update or what you're posting to a friend's page, then take it into your own hands and say, hey, you know, this doesn't seem right, or, you know, report it to Facebook. Take that opportunity to do something yourself. That sort of jogged my memory, too. There's another thing. You could do, which I thought was kind of an ingenious way of a way of sort of monitoring traffic that, you know, maybe isn't left in the hands of Facebook. One of the things you can do is if you set up your own website, let's say just a random website on something that you suspect that you, or one of the things you do, you set up a website and then you get on your child's Facebook page and you like that page, right? You actually have a Facebook like to it. Now, one of the things you do is setting up a web page is you can then perform an analysis of that web page to see, monitor traffic that also likes it. Because one of the things that we do know from the way that a child or predator or pedophile tends to get onto the Facebook page and like the same things as that particular child, that victim, right?
Right. That's the danger of hashtags.
Right. No, absolutely. But once you set up that website, as soon as that predator or that person likes that page, all of a sudden you have an IP address, right, for that particular person. Mm. And behind it, what you can do is you can actually locate it pretty quickly within a very small square block area, right? In other words, somewhere in the universe. And I had this kind of happen to me recently, and I no longer am blogging actively per se. But I had this comment come up, and it looked very odd. And I did do some analysis of it and discovered that it was somebody who was posting a comment on my blog from their cell phone in, I believe it was Massachusetts or New Hampshire. And I could really get very close to exactly their location. I mean, I'm not sure if people understand just how huge their virtual footprint is.
Mm-hmm.
So you can do stuff on your own, too. Besides, you know, leaving it in the hands of setting out guidelines for these social networks and whatnot. And I do hope that they are doing that.
Right. Well, in our next segment, we'll discuss more about the combined efforts of from different directions that will be needed to make online life safer. And we'll be talking more with Professor Joe Ulatowski from UTEP.
Hear archived shows at thesocialnetworkshow.com. Follow us on Twitter at @SocialNetShow or TSN Station.
Today in school, I learned a lot. In chemistry, I learned that no one likes me. In biology, I learned that I'm fat and stupid. In English, I learned that I'm disgusting. And in gym, I learned that I'm pathetic and a joke. The only thing I didn't learn in school today is why no one ever helps.
Kids witness bullying every day. They want to help, but they don't know how. Teach them how to stop bullying and be more than a bystander at stopbullying.gov. A message from the Ad Council.
Now, back to the Social Network Show.
Welcome back to the Social Network Show, and we are talking with Joe Ulatowski from the University of Texas, El Paso, and he is a professor of philosophy dealing with the ethics involved with social media and networking. And Joe, I wanted to mention before we go into another topic that there's a service called You Know Kids, and that is something that parents can use also to help monitor their kids, you know, see, just make sure that they're not getting any weird followers and so forth. So You Know Kids is a good tool. Now, I wanted to ask you about this, the balance between freedom of speech, because we always hear about people who think their freedom of speech will be impinged if they have to stop abusing people, and the protection of potential targets of abuse. That's been pretty well established by law in the face-to-face world quite a bit. Why is it so hard to see how those principles apply to the internet? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's a hard question. And so I would say it's basically the following. It's a lot like this is how I like to put it. And that is that, you know, in face-to-face interaction, you don't, I mean, even if you're angry with, say, a friend or spouse or even just someone you meet on the street, okay, you don't just start flipping out and yelling at them for whatever it is that they might have done or how they might have ticked you off at that point, right? So there's a kind of etiquette, there's a way in which we interact with the world around us that is abided by mostly by everybody in the world. I mean, there are some anomalies, fair enough, okay? But then as we get further and further away from that face-to-face interaction, say, for instance, on the phone, I can tell you probably numerous times I've said some things to customer service in various places for various reasons that I probably regret now because, you know, it's not as intimate as, say, being on the street, right? So you tend to have some distance from it, so some kind of cognitive distance from the person on the other end of the line, and you say some things that you probably wouldn't say to them in person.
Yeah, because you don't think you're as identifiable. You're not standing right in front of them to where and or in the same area or neighborhood where they're going to see you again and they'll know who you are. Because, yeah, I have to admit that I've, you know, lost my patience with someone on the phone. Probably Absolutely. Somebody trying to help, but not doing a good job of it.
Right, right. Well, and it gets, and as you get into the internet now it's a different, it's not different per se in terms of there are other people out there, but it's different in the sense that it's written, right? Everything is written down, and you're viewing it online. And so that distance is even further from you being on the internet. You're not on the phone. You're not talking to them person to person, not talking to them on the phone. And so there's been some, in some cases, I think, among people, right, that they don't respect the written word nearly as well as they would in speaking with one another. And they think that that's gives them some distance. And so they think that they can get away with writing things on various Facebook pages or Twitter feeds or whatnot that they wouldn't get away with on the phone or in person to person. So there's sort of a progression of distance between being face-to-face in the so-called real-time and then in the metaverse.
We had a guy on a long time ago, it seems like almost a year ago, and he talked about the telephone being the first instrument of virtual reality in that very sense that it's once removed or even further than once removed from that face-to-face interaction. And then last week we had a guest that talked about the illusion of aloneness in the sense that people were trying to get a handle on people sitting in a room alone on a computer, feeling alone physically, but being connected to the whole world virtually. You know what I mean? And
sure.
There's all those parts, but I mean, the fact, I think it was absolutely brilliant that you point out that when we're face to face, we tend to be more careful. And the further we get away from that, than the telephone, we're a little less careful. And then the written word, even a little less careful than that. Very interesting. And of course, that danger can increase there too, right?
Oh, yeah, certainly. Absolutely.
Well, feeling that you're alone or at least in a safe place, say you're in your living room or bedroom, and that gives you a false sense of security if you end up being the victim, in the sense that you might reveal things that are not good to reveal to just the whole entire world. But then, as you say, there's on the other side of it, too, nobody's watching me. I can say whatever I want. Now, you mentioned self-interest, and I'm just trying to get a handle on now, how is it in someone's self-interest to be vile or vicious or malicious?
Right. let's see, I'm not sure I'm the best person to ask about that. That might be a psychologist's view. I would have a better view on that. But I'd say that, you know, there, in some way, there could be some kind of evolutionary explanation for it. You know, you're trying to become the alpha person in the relationship, whatever the case may be. Or it could be, I mean, look, some people are just mean. Let's just
right.
start there.
Whenever
right?
I say why, Jim's always going to remind me that one out of 25 people is a sociopath.
right. So, I mean, that's my best guess at such thing. I mean, why they do have these, you know, posts on various friends' websites. I mean, so-called friends, I guess, right? And that's my best guess at that.
Yeah, that's a whole other subject, too, is how the younger people, their concept of what a friend is has mm-hmm. a lot to do with it. And I've also seen reality TV implicated in this, that the maliciousness or backbiting and sabotaging and so forth is stock and trade for the reality TV shows, and that is the enculturation that's going on among many of the younger generation. At least those, I mean, obviously anybody of any age could be watching them, but the impressionable tendency would be most with the youngest people.
There's an analogy coming from a clinical background. There's something in the sense that there used to be an old saying, it's still out there, hurt people hurt people. And then so you look back at a lot of the criminal activity that happens even now. If you do look back at the backgrounds of some of the criminals, you see a lot of abuse where they were abused, abandoned, neglected, etc. But the anomaly can be the sociopath who has no conscience and only cares about winning. But having said that, there's a certain side of it, I think, that in the working as a crisis interventionist for almost 20 years, I ran across one analogy that I always loved, and that was we were dealing a lot with batterers, okay? So the people that hurt their spouse and et cetera, et cetera. And so there was one point where it became almost habitual to be that mean, that abusive, to hit and really hurt the person that you were with or they were with. And at one point someone said, however, if you put a whole gang in front of them, people that were armed, all of a sudden they get real good control of their behavior. Mm-hmm. You know, and so I think it's back to what you said, which again I think is a really brilliant baseline, is what are our protocols and our feelings and our behaviors when we're face to face? I mean, if that's our baseline, then we might know how far off base we are. At least we have a baseline. You know what I mean?
Yes, certainly. I think that's right. And if there's any kind of noticeable change in the person-to-person interaction, then certainly it's going to bleed into the other parts of your interactions with others, which would include, of course, social networking.
Right. So the relaxing of surveillance, you might say, will take people farther off their baseline, but if their baseline is
well, no, you mean by like a self-assessment, right? Because in a sense, surveilling of, I think we're living in a time, and especially I know they're in Las Vegas for sure. We're living in a time where surveillance is all over the place. I mean, that you can walk down the strip without being surveilled upon by various cameras, I think, is nearly impossible.
Well, that's true, but you know how much feedback you get from it? Usually zero. There's surveillance that I'm thinking of is something that will have some consequences. You know, like if you're in your hometown neighborhood and your parents are keeping an eye on you and your grandparents and the neighbors and the cousins, you know, I mean, there's
oh, right.
that
yep.
type of surveillance has consequences. Whereas if somebody's cheating at the casino tables or something, yeah, there will be consequences. But in general terms, that is perhaps, you know, what, going back to the whole question of the social network behavior, though, I think it might be good to focus on content rather than the source. And I think that in bullying and cyberbullying research, they're trying to do that too. Concentrate on it as a behavior, not identifying the person as a bully, but this was socially inappropriate behavior. So that would call into action the tremendous power of data mining and so forth, that, you know, we may think, oh, there's so many messages, how could we keep, you know, how could we keep an eye on what's being said? Well, it's entirely possible to keep an eye on what's being said, because that is the incredible power of the electronic age, the digital age. So any other thoughts in closing, Joe?
Well, just the surveillance bit is very interesting, especially even the social networking bit. I mean, there are innumerable cases, criminally speaking, that, for instance, a person stole a woman's cell phone. I think it was in the state of Georgia, if I remember correctly, and took a selfie, a self-picture with that cell phone, and it immediately uploaded to Facebook. And all of her friends who were actually around her said, hey, why did this guy just take a picture on your cell phone? And that was when she realized that it was this person had stolen her cell phone. It also told the location, because apparently there's like a GPS find there. So, I mean, yeah, granted, this content is critical. I mean, because it's like, I mean, it's not just, you know, the status updates per se, but I mean, it certainly will help in solving crimes and hopefully in at least acting better, so you don't steal someone's phone. I mean,
and then take a picture of yourself. Terminal stupidity there, but
right.
Thank you so much for coming on, and we hope you come back.
I appreciate it. Thank you for having me on, for sure.
Thank you. And we've been talking with Dr. Joe Ulatowski, and a researcher on ethics in social media.
You've been listening to The Social Network Show at thesocialnetworkshow.com, thesocialnetworkstation.com, and on Twitter at Social Net Show and at TSN Station. We welcome you, and we hope you come back. Thank you.
You've been listening to The Social Network Show, the only worldwide show dedicated to social networking and social media, coming to you from the studios of the Hank Greenspan School of Journalism and Media Studies of UNLV, the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. Listen to archived shows and follow us on Twitter. The views expressed on The Social Network Show are those of the hosts and guests and may not be the views of Social Network Intermedia. The Social Network Show is produced by Social Network Intermedia, copyright 2012.